You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show.
We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter Pax Americana. Beyond the economic and business arena, U.S. business leaders could play a more effective role in more traditional foreign policy. No doubt most U.S. CEOs, political leaders, and even many citizens will recoil at the notion of crossing the line between economics and politics. If ever there was a bogus distinction, though, this is it. Putting business and economics in one box and politics and security in another amounts to misreading the nature of global interaction today. Virtually all countries are concerned with all dimensions of their existence. They want growth and they want prosperity, certainly, but they want freedom of action and dignity as well. In this regard, foreign attitudes towards Americanization of the markets cannot be divorced from foreign views about broader U.S. behavior. If CEOs want the EU and Japan to let up on nationalistic drives in the commercial sphere, then other governments will have to be given some quote-unquote face in other areas so that they do not feel totally cornered by Uncle Sam. There is a seamless connection between economics and politics when it comes to anti-Americanism in particular. For example, the American Union wants a stronger defense capability with some independence from the United States. A confident U.S., reflecting its unequaled strength, would not fight the proposition, as seems to be the case so often now. It would see political merit in encouraging a strong and confident Europe, which could, on its own, handle crises in its backyard and the civil wars in Bosnia, Serbia, and Kosovo. It would work with Europe to build transatlantic defense companies in which both sides receive their share of procurement. This is the best way to relieve pressure on nationalistic tendencies, and U.S. CEOs should, in fact, be helping U.S. officials to understand the eventual liability of a winner-take-all strategy. A final area of U.S. foreign policy which ought to concern CEOs is adequate funding for the full range of U.S. diplomacies. As the number of complex problems increases, from trade and finance to illegal drugs and terrorism, from protection for our diplomats to protection of the environment, the non-military international affairs budget continues to shrink. And the United States doesn't pay its full dues for UN peacekeeping. It doesn't lead the way in adequately funding the World Trade Organization and other global institutions. Many of its embassy facilities are in a state of crisis. U.S. CEOs ought to weigh in forcefully on the side of Washington having tools to conduct a modern foreign policy. Next chapter, Reflections. Historians cannot agree on what happened in the past, so it is little more than speculation to suggest how, looking back years from now, they might view our times. During my interview with Emma Rothschild, who runs the Center for History and Economics at King's College at Cambridge University in England, she talked about the powerful interpersonal forces that created the first industrial revolution in England, ranging from the steam engine to the French Revolution. In another interview, Harvard Business School historian Richard Tedlow explained the critical role played by individual business leaders during the Second Industrial Revolution in America. Different times, different perspectives, but it seems certain that the history of our era will also be the story of both shifting political, economic, and social forces, and the strenuous efforts of individual business leaders who confronted powerful trends and even tried to shape them. If I had to guess, however, I would say that today's CEOs will be seen as captains of ships in a turbulent sea, unable to chart a steady course and to maintain control of their own fate, at least to the extent most people imagine they can. Their considerable skills and determination notwithstanding, the pressures of this era will have proved much greater than anything these individuals could handle well. The challenges that will have arisen of the internet, of globalization, of creating trust in the face of rapid change, of putting forward a bold vision and executing it exquisitely, of balancing shareholders and stakeholders, and of understanding the need for a broader vision and leadership in society. These challenges will be assessed by historians as having been too difficult for most CEOs to successfully handle all at once. Even in the months between my interviews and the writing of this book, the vulnerabilities of top business leaders began to emerge starkly. Aside from the fact that well-trained leaders like Richard Huber, Richard Thoman, and Rebecca Mark were toppled by the fall of 2000, the press was speculating about the vulnerability of Michael Armstrong, who was forced to break up AT&T and to boost its sagging share price. The reputation of Rolf Brewer never fully recovered from the botched merger between Deutsche Bank and Dresdner, and his board took the unusual step of naming the person who would succeed him in 2002. Perhaps signaling an exit for Brewer in advance of what he had originally planned. William Ford's personal agony over the recall of Firestone tires and the ramifications for everything he wanted for the company can hardly be imagined. Well, Michael Dell's company, the single best performing stock of the 1990s, with a 97% average annual price increase during the decade, saw its market value drop 25% in the first 8 months of the year 2000. More than a fickle stock market was to blame. The box that made Michael Dell a billionaire has become a commodity product no longer technologically innovative and no longer in need of replacement every 18 months, wrote the Wall Street Journal. Dell needs to push into internet servers and high-end data storage. Both are largely, unfortunately, terra incognita for Dell. In September 2000, Andrew Grove's Intel lost 22% of its value, the worst one-day drop in its history, because of lowered expectations for earnings, but also because of anticipated changes in the market for computers. When GE and Honeywell announced that they would merge in October 2000, it seemed likely that the latter would dissolve and disappear into Jack Welch's empire, and that Bonsignori would be out of a job. Amid substantial losses, George Soros slimmed down his fund management firm, saying that the business required younger blood. Motorola, Unisys, and Daimler Chrysler were all experiencing serious declines in market valuation in late 2000. These price gyrations were due in part to the ups and downs of markets. But Wall Street analysts and investors were also worried about the fundamental outlook for strategies and execution. And these were only the leaders that I interviewed. Elsewhere, Bill Gates was able to appeal his antitrust conviction. But by October 2000, Microsoft had lost half its value since the start of the year. Louis Grishner felt compelled to institute a sweeping reorganization of IBM to enhance sagging revenues and better execute the plan in the next stage of the internet strategy. Jeff Bezos' Amazon.com, facing continuing financial losses, gave up not only a huge amount of its financial value, but lost much of its luster as a model for the internet age. Jay Walker, Priceland.com's founder and leader, could not have been too happy either. Not only was the company's market value plummeting, but its name your own price strategy had failed almost everywhere except in the travel industry. Yahoo, dependent as it was on internet advertising, was also worrying investors. Of course, some CEOs were still riding high. Jack Welch, John Brown, Ken Chenault, Henry Paulson, Hiroshi Okuda, and Marin Sorrell among them. And many who seemed to be in trouble would no doubt rebound. But the landscape did not reflect the enormity of the challenge these men and women face in simply succeeding at running their companies at this time in our history. From the vantage point of, say, the year 2010, we may have the answers to questions that now we can only ask. Must CEOs be in sole charge of multinational corporate Goliaths, or can responsibility be shared by separating the jobs of CEO and chairman and holding the board of directors more accountable for a company's behavior? Or is it the inevitable nature of things that, like Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, quote, an institution is the lengthened shadow of one man, unquote? A second question. In the current business revolution, with its constantly changing business models and its hyper-volatile stocks, can CEOs build great enduring companies, or are they forced to respond so quickly to fickle consumers and investors that there's no time for long-term thinking? And question three, will we have sorted out, at least somewhat, the relative roles of public and private sectors on both our national and international arenas? Or is this destined to be a never-ending and inconclusive struggle? If this were a novel with a plot, how would it come out? There are three possibilities. Global CEOs could find themselves able to remain preoccupied with beating their competition, while some of the bigger societal issues are handled by a combination of governments, NGOs, and market forces. Basically, a continuation of current trends. Alternately, hostility against global corporations could become a powerful force, throwing the companies off course and causing governments to intervene with stepped-up regulatory efforts. A third possibility is that global companies will become both business empires and social organizations, giving far more attention than they already do to deliberately shaping and improving the social and political environment in which they operate. Based on my interviews, I would predict that we will see a combination of all three. But based on what I believe will be required in the future for corporate success, it's the third scenario, a simultaneous focus on profits and community that ought to become the model for our big companies. Only historians will be able to assess what actually happened with what results.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garten, which is a book that looks at the future of the corporation. We're still in the chapter, Reflections. CEOs, and all of us for that matter, can be forgiven if the interaction of business and society is almost too complicated to deal with, except on perhaps a superficial level. How could it be otherwise when markets, technology, consumer needs and tastes, public attitudes, and the roles of governments and international organizations are all in flux? Amid such shifting foundations, the chances of finding the right answers will be related to whenever we're asking the right questions. On this score, historians may conclude that our framework for analysis was itself inadequate. Historian Emil Rothschild compared the environment for important big ideas in the First Industrial Revolution to that of today, when she said, quote, "Certainly, political debates and parliamentary debates are much more about ideas than they are now." I asked her about the absence today of great economic and political philosophers who could shed light on changing economic and social circumstances around the world. There was a cost to the tremendous specialization in academia, she said. A lot of political leaders and public figures over the last 10 years have been aware that we were living in a period of momentous change when ideas were very important. And they haven't found an easy way to communicate with political philosophers in universities. The problem is compounded by the need to have a discussion across borders, she said. Quote, "How do you have a debate about big global changes when people who come from completely different intellectual backgrounds, where the only common language is a kind of English that nobody speaks well?" Rothschild's lament came in mind in October of the year 2000, when Dr. James H. Billington, Librarian of Congress, announced a $60 million grant to find a cadre of scholars to reside in the library who would then interact with American politicians. Quote, "These two worlds just kind of fell apart in the 1960s and haven't really come back together again," he said. "We're trying to celebrate and facilitate not just the life of the mind, but also the role, the life of the mind and the life of the republic. It's a start, but the experiment will eventually need to be expanded to global dimensions and to include interaction and business leaders. Otherwise, it will be but a partial effort to come to grips with the challenges of our times." Susan Beresford had a similar perspective. Quote, "Since we are in this rapidly, deeply broadening, changing world, and everything is uncertain, one of our great challenges is to create the analytical structures to keep us reflecting on the right things. We have universities and think tanks and researchers and journalists and poets and artists to help us. But the question is whether they are up to the task, whether they are too rigid, whether they are open enough, whether they are composed of the people who are diverse enough to understand and think about what is going on together. In light of everything else that CEOs need to do, it's not surprising that they are not often thought about being an essential part of the dialogue on the direction of society in this new century. There are some exceptions, such as John Brown, George Soros, Jürgen Schrempf, and William Ford, all of whom have proactively jumped into the debates about globalization. However, many more CEOs ought to be involved, for what makes this era different from previous industrial revolutions is that the leaders of multinational companies have much more influence by virtue of what they do or don't do than did their forebears. This is all the more true given that we live in a global setting, lacking in so many of the governing structures that we take for granted at a national level. Historians will no doubt wrestle with whether or not today's CEOs mirrored the values of our times, and best of them and the worst, that they were likely to conclude that they did. To the extent that the twilight of the 20th century and the dawn of the 21st was about increasing freedom, including the unleashing of global capitalism all over the world, today's CEOs were right there, making it happen, profiting from it, and throwing off benefits for others, such as customers, employees, and shareholders. If the prevailing tendency was to concentrate on the short term, assuming either that the good times would last or that the future was too complex and uncertain to deal with, then global CEOs mirrored that as well. If our era is judged as one of rampant materialism, greed, and a callousness toward widening social inequities, then CEOs also played their part. In the book The Mask of Command, his classic thesis on military leadership, historian John Keegan made a similar point. Quote, generalship is much more than command of the armies in the field, when he wrote, quote, for an army is an expression of the society from which it issues. The purpose for which it fights and the way it does so will, therefore, be determined in a large measure by what a society wants from war and how far it expects its army to go in delivering that outcome. A general may, given strong character traits and effective behavior, carry both society and army further when they wish to travel. But he, too, will be the last resort, act like a man of his time and place. In sticking to their knitting, in keeping their time horizon short, in taking a modest view of their role in society, most CEOs are doing just what might be expected if you looked at the environment for which they came. Maybe that is inevitable, but can we not expect more? We're not underestimating the opportunity for business leadership as we make the journey from the industrial age to the information age, with all the wonderful and painful transformations that will entail. In my 5 years at the Yale School of Management, I've seen hundreds of students wondering what was their role as business leaders should be. Of course, many of them want to lead corporations and banks. Many want to be investors and start up new companies. And a good number hope to make a lot of money. But if you listen carefully to the questions they ask, and many of the CEOs who come to the campus, the theme is not stock prices, but the soul of the leader and his or her company. How do chief executives see their jobs in relation to all else that is going on in the world? Where do they fit into the big forces acting on society? The students understand and reflect on the achievements of the CEOs in the business world as they are narrowly defined. They want the same for themselves, but most of them seem to want more as well. Susan Beresford raised the same issue in our interview. One of the positive things about change and uncertainty is that it prompts a search for values that can guide people in this new period. She said, in the 1980s, we saw the rise of a sharper, more competitive dog-eat-dog kind of business leadership. In the younger generations today, we may be seeing a group with a set of values and interest in the environment or poverty or health who are not going to be able to totally put these things aside as they come into leadership positions, because they are integral to their understanding of how the world should be for the lives and for their own lives and for the lives of their children. Let's hope that she is right. So that is the end of the book, The Mind of the CEO, Looking at the Future of the Corporation. My comment on the book is that since then, more than 20 years have passed, and we now see corporations entering into areas that were never envisioned by the original CEOs, like, for example, the growth of stakeholder capitalism as opposed to profit capitalism, which was predominant when this book was written. So we have also the rise of DEI, we have the rise of affirmative action, and so on, to make boards more equitable, to make the composition of companies more balanced and equitable. Also that companies that do industrial work must consider zero emissions as part of their business strategy, something that was never mentioned in the earlier times. And also a lot of work aiming not only to deliver a profit to shareholders, but also to help improve society in various ways. So these are some of the new developments that have occurred since this book was written. So next, we are going to, for next week, we're going to be looking at a book called What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy. The description I'll very quickly give is: the news is full of their names, supposedly the vanguard of a rethinking of capitalism. Luft, Airbnb, TaskRabbit, Uber, and many more companies have a mandate of disruption and ending the old order, and they've succeeded in effecting the biggest change in the American workforce in over a century, according to former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. But this new wave of technology companies is funded and steered by very old-school venture capitalists. And in What's Yours is Mine, technologist Tom Slee argues that the so-called sharing economy damages development, extends harsh free market practices into previously protected areas of our lives, and presents the opportunity for a few people to make fortunes on the back of communities. So we're going to be looking at that next show, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. A recently released study from the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences has identified a stark decrease in the monitoring of Pacific salmon populations.